Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Secret Lives of Bats, My Adventures with the World's Most Misunderstood Mammals, by Merlin Tuttle, narrated by Sean Burnett. Preface: A City That Loves Bats. Newspaper headlines screamed, "Bat colonies sink teeth into city." They claimed that hundreds of thousands of rabid bats were invading and attacking the citizens of Austin, Texas. It was September 23, 1984, and 1.5 million Brazilian free-tailed bats had begun moving into 16-inch deep crevices beneath the Congress Avenue Bridge, just a few blocks from the state capitol. For more than a decade, Americans had been bombarded with scary newspaper and magazine stories that often included vividly imaginative accounts of rabid bats attacking people. The Nightmare House, which appeared in the April 1, 1980 issue of Family Circle, even went so far as to claim that a family had been trapped in their home for 3 days and nights while a horde of bats attacked. When Austin health officials added their warnings, many Austinites panicked and wanted the bats exterminated. Rather than viewing the great clouds of emerging bats as a wonder of nature, they were reminded of Alfred Hitchcock's terrifying classic, The Birds. Not surprisingly, people began imagining attacks from bats that were merely chasing flying insects, and Austin suddenly became the world center for scary bat stories. Having just founded Bat Conservation International, BCI, to help people understand and appreciate bats, I felt that the new onslaught of frightening claims presented an extreme challenge. Nevertheless, I truly believed that Austin provided a golden opportunity to demonstrate that bats make wonderful neighbors. When I announced my resignation as curator of mammals at the Milwaukee Public Museum in Wisconsin so I could move BCI to Austin, nearly everyone thought I'd lost my mind. On learning of my plans, Texas Monthly Magazine gave me its Bum Steer Award, a tongue-in-cheek distinction given for especially embarrassing decisions. With only one employee, I moved BCI to Austin in March 1986. We were just in time for the bats' spring return, and within days, armed with several live ones, I began meeting with leading city officials, community leaders, and media representatives. Fortunately, the truth about bats is extremely powerful. Free-tailed bats have strange faces, but their big brown eyes, winsome expressions, and gentle nature quickly converted countless skeptics. People frequently lost their fear in the blink of a bat's eye. When prominent socialite Roberta Crenshaw was informed of my efforts, she declared he might as well try saving cockroaches. She assured her friends that if she had to view one of my bats up close, she'd probably have nightmares for a month. Yet when she finally gave in and took a look, she exclaimed, "Oh my, it's cute." And she became one of America's first supporters of BCI and an outspoken promoter of Austin's bat. Just 2 months after awarding me, Texas Monthly featured a story strongly supporting my bat conservation efforts. And just 4 years later, at a bridgeside ceremony attended by nearly 700 people, Mayor Lee Cook proudly announced, "We've become the bat capital of America. It's really exciting that we've come from concern to a position where we want to protect, covet, and welcome the bats." Even Governor Ann Richards became a bat fan. Soon after her election in 1991, she invited me to bring my bats to dinner to entertain her friends at the governor's mansion. It was an evening frequently punctuated by exclamations of, "Wow, I had no idea. Did I hear you right? Bats from just one cave can eat more than 100 tons of insects in a single night, and you really can train them like dogs." Time and again, in my more than 50 years of studying bats, I've seen similarly dramatic conversions, perhaps explaining why I was brave enough to tackle Austin. It is simply amazing how quickly attitudes improve when people finally understand bats as they really are. Sophisticated, beautiful, even cute, quite aside from their crucial roles as primary predators of insects, pollinators of flowers, and dispersers of seeds. Austin now carefully protects its bats and has become the world center for stories documenting bats as safe neighbors and valued allies. In more than 30 years of sharing our city with the world's largest urban bat colony, no one has been harmed. And simply left alone, these bats consume 15 tons of insects nightly. They also bring $12 million tourist dollars to downtown Austin each summer. On a typical August evening, people from all over the world line the Congress Avenue Bridge, jockeying shoulder to shoulder for favored views of the great emergence columns, truly one of our planet's premier wildlife spectacles. The bats pass within just a few feet of a flickering storm of flashing cameras, up to 5 columns at a time that can be seen for more than a mile as great black ribbons against sunset skies. Of course, I can't share live bats close up, or even Austin's bridge bats, with more than a privileged few. However, in the following chapters, I will share highlights from a lifetime of thrilling adventure and scientific discovery, covering every continent where bats live. From moonshiner standoffs to close encounters with tigers, cobras, and poachers, and bats as cute as any panda, and as strange as any dinosaur, tiny bumblebee bats to giant flying foxes. Follow along, and I hope that through my adventures, you too will become passionate about bats. Chapter 1. Teenage Discoveries. I've always been fascinated by nature, so when, at age 17, I discovered thousands of gray bats, now referred to as gray myotis, doing things that, according to books of the day, they weren't supposed to do, I was immediately intrigued. It all began in April 1959, when a high school acquaintance told me about a bat cave near my home west of Knoxville, Tennessee. Baloney Cave was named for its baloney-shaped formations, and it was said to sometimes shelter thousands of bats. The next weekend, I easily persuaded my father, who was always open for a new adventure, to help me find it. We headed out on a beautiful spring afternoon. The sun was bright and the air was scented with honeysuckle blossoms as we followed a barely visible trail along a fence, then into the shade of stately old oak and hickory trees. A half mile later, we found ourselves staring into a gaping pit, about 12 feet in diameter at the top, sloping down like an antlion funnel. Limestone walls adorned in moss and ferns dripped from recent showers. This, clearly, was the cave my friend had described. Wondering if the bats would still be there, we carefully climbed down into the cooler entrance, jumping the last few feet to the floor. Before venturing into the dark interior, we retrieved our new miner's caps and carbide lamps from our knapsacks and added fuel. Each lamp included an upper and a lower chamber. We added quarter-inch chunks of carbide into the lower ones and poured water into the upper ones. When water contacts carbide, it produces acetylene gas. And when the gas exits through a tiny nozzle in the middle of a shiny metal reflector, it can be lit with a spark from an embedded flint. This provided each of us with a half-inch flame for light. We could alter the brightness by adjusting a lever, which controlled the rate at which the water dripped onto the carbide. Even at their brightest, these lamps were dim compared to today's LED lights, but they were the best we had. After allowing our eyes to adjust to the yellowish glow of our lamps, we began to look around, first noticing a room the size of a small bedroom on our left. It was strewn with old moonshine still paraphernalia, broken mason jars, and parts of wooden barrels. The ceiling was smoke-blackened from the distilling process. Far more concerned about finding bats, we would later regret having assumed that moonshine stills in Baloney Cave were limited to the far distant past. This was our first venture into a cave. My father led the way as we stepped carefully around slick spots on an uneven floor, our hands often supporting us against the moist limestone walls. After going by several side passages, my father exclaimed, "Wow, look at this!" We were just entering a room the size of a two-car garage, which our dim lights barely covered. Along one side, baloney-shaped formations ran down a wall into a pit. Because the bottom was beyond the reach of our lights, it seemed endlessly deep. "I sure hope the bats don't live beyond that," I commented, pointing into the chasm. So far, we hadn't seen any bats, though the cave floor was often strewn with a soft, dry accumulation of old droppings, commonly called guano. Although we were a little nervous about becoming lost, we decided to search the side passages. Some were quite narrow, requiring tight squeezes. My father finally suggested we return to the entrance and try to follow the most recent bat droppings, like a proverbial trail of breadcrumbs. As we were beginning again, we noticed a big difference between bats and rodent droppings. Bat droppings were similar to mouse pellets, about a quarter inch long by less than an eighth inch wide. However, unlike those of deer mice and pack rats, which also frequent caves, once bat droppings dried, they easily crumbled into dozens of tiny fragments that reflected our lamp's light in a rainbow of colors. The reflections came from tiny bits of insects the bats had eaten. Rodent droppings were composed mostly of plant material. They were hardened like bits of gravel and failed to reflect light. By following only the freshest trail of evidence, we were able to move ahead with much greater confidence. A few minutes later, through a small hole in a wall, I heard my first chittering bats. On the far side of a small room, I could barely make out a furry mat of several thousand gray myotis covering the ceiling. They apparently had heard us coming and were rapidly waking up. Clutching my butterfly net in one hand, I desperately attempted to scramble through the hole in time to catch a few before they could escape, but to no avail. Suddenly, the air was virtually saturated with flying bats. Dozens were landing on my head and shoulders because I was inadvertently blocking their escape. They were crawling down my neck and into my shirt sleeves. No need for a net. But I soon realized that they meant no harm and were only seeking places to hide. In fact, they had far more to fear than I did. This was my first lesson in the gentle nature of bats, especially those that form large colonies. They neither scratched nor bit me as they swarmed over me, though I did have to hold quite still in order to avoid inadvertently crushing them. When the pandemonium finally cleared, my father helped me retreat from the hole, clutching a couple of struggling specimens, which we gently placed in a cloth bag. Back at the cave entrance, we got out my father's Peterson Field Guide to Mammals to identify our bats. Based on their unicolor gray fur, we easily identified them as gray myotis, Myotis grisescens. All other cave-dwelling bats of North America have bi- or tricolored fur. That is, each hair has a dark base and lighter tip, or is banded dark, light, and darker from base to tip. Curious to see how many bats would emerge to feed that evening, we waited in the cave entrance. The first individuals left about a half hour after sunset, followed by a steady stream of thousands. We sat quietly, listening to the flutter of wings, which sometimes passed within inches of our faces. I was enthralled. Where were they going, and when would they return? Several nights later, when we brought my mother back to see these bats emerge, we had a big disappointment. The few books of the time that mentioned gray myotis stated that they lived in a single cave year-round. Nevertheless, ours had disappeared. Speculating that perhaps gray myotis just didn't come out every night, we returned repeatedly to check their roosting area and watch for emergences at the entrance. But they were gone. They returned in September, then mysteriously disappeared again. Had they gone somewhere else for the winter? I was determined to find out. With help from my father and some high school friends, I thoroughly explored even the innermost reaches of Baloney Cave on the chance that our bats had simply found a remote area where they could hibernate undisturbed. But we found no sign of them. When our bats briefly returned and left again the following spring, I was convinced they must be migrating, despite books I'd read that said they didn't migrate. Armed with field notes documenting when the bats were present versus absent, and two museum-type voucher specimens to substantiate my identification, I convinced my mother to drive me to Washington, D.C., so I could meet with scientists at the Smithsonian's Division of Mammals. Blindly hoping we would be able to find scientists who could help, we approached the Smithsonian reception desk and announced we had bat specimens we'd like to discuss with their mammalogists. The receptionist calmly called Dr. Charles Handley, who headed the Division of Mammals, and a few minutes later he met us at the elevator. Dr. Handley, a bat specialist who eventually would become my mentor in a career as a professional bat biologist, had received guidance at an early age himself and was delighted to help me. Before we left, my mother and I had been taken on a grand tour of their vast collections and invited to come back any time. He also introduced us to John Paradiso, the person in charge of bat banding for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Bird and Mammal Laboratories. Impressed with my field notes and specimens, he encouraged me to take several thousand bat bands to see if I could track gray myotis movements. He explained, "Each band has a unique number and says, 'Write USFWS, Wash, D.C.' If someone finds a bat with one of your bands on its arm, they may write and tell us where they found it, and we'll let you know." The bands were sequentially numbered in lots of 100 and strung on fine wires. Each had to be carefully pried open, with the two lips exactly parallel to avoid injuring wings when closing them around bat forearms. We would have to open our bands exactly an eighth of an inch, then restring them on a larger plastic-coated electrical wire. Once captured, each bat would have a band slipped over one of its forearms. A bat's forearm is the same as ours, except for the attachment of a wing membrane along the rear edge. That membrane connects the body to the arm and fingers to form a wing. When mostly closed, the band would not fall off, but it would not pinch the bat's wing membrane. I could hardly wait to get home to inform my father and begin planning how we would capture and band our bats. Before we could band any bats, though, I had to open and restring each band in numerical order. It was a time-consuming task that limited the number of bats we could band. By early September, I had 200 bands opened and ready for use. My father had made me a special hand net with an extendable handle, and I was equipped with a new field notebook. I could hardly wait to get started. But time after time, we found few, if any, gray myotis in Baloney Cave. By late September, we were seriously disappointed. Did they come every year, or perhaps only sometimes? In early October, following several cool nights, we re-entered the cave and quickly headed for the bat's last known roosting site in the inner room. Faint squeaks from above alerted us that we were about to walk right by a small cluster of gray myotis. They covered only a little more than a square foot, so I was able to clamp my hand net to the ceiling around them without harming any. When the frightened bats attempted to fly, they all fell into my nylon net. This was perfect. We'd found all we were prepared to band, and they were sleepy enough to be caught. Carrying our netted bats, we scrambled up to a flat rock just outside the entrance and began sorting them by sex. Bat sexes are easily distinguished, just as in most other mammals. There were 226 males and 12 females, of which we banded 199. The next day, we returned to find a similar number of bats in the same place, but we were surprised not to find a single banded individual. Had our bats somehow gotten rid of their bands, or had they left and been replaced by newly arriving bats? We wouldn't know the answer until we found some of our banded bats. The odds of someone else finding one of our banded bats and actually reporting it to the Fish and Wildlife Service were slim, based on the prior experiences of others, less than 1 in 1,000. However, Dr. Wayne Davis, a bat-banding biologist in Kentucky, who would soon co-author the book Bats of America, encouraged me in the possibility of finding some of my own banded bats. I had become acquainted with him through Paradiso at the Smithsonian, and he, too, became very helpful. The best hope seemed to be to find our own bats, but only if they hadn't gone too far. For several months, my father and I had been asking neighbors, especially old-timers, if they knew of possible bat caves in the area. We'd heard plenty of wild tales about caves surrounded by endless mysteries, most not involving bats. In those days, people thought us crazy to be looking for bats, especially since we didn't seem interested in killing them. Even when we did hear about real bat caves and went to check them, we mostly found just sticks and stones, evidence of people's frequent efforts to kill bats at their easily recognized roosts. When active gray myotis roost on limestone cave ceilings, their tiny claws, combined with the acidic action of carbon dioxide from their breath, etch the soft stone. Long-term contact stains the rock a rusty red color. The etched and stained roosts remain recognizable for many years after bats have left or been extirpated. Even from our earliest observations, it was obvious that gray myotis had declined alarmingly. To find them would require exploring caves or parts of caves that humans seldom visited, often because they were remote or dangerous to enter. One old man's story particularly caught our attention. We found him cooling off on a hot August weekend in a small country store. When he heard us asking the owner about caves with bats, he came over with an incredible tale. When I was just a young'un, my buddy and me sneaked into a cave what people thereabouts was afeard of, could drop rocks in an opening and hear 'em going deep, deep down. The doc what owned it tried to keep people away, afeard they'd fall in and be hurt bad. We was scared, too, but we did sneak in fur enough to see it be plumb full of bats. Them suckers was covering everything, like swarms o' bees. Near scared us to death. He went on to explain that the cave was located in a remote hollow between Clinch Mountain and Kyle's Ford, a bit more than 100 miles northeast of Knoxville. Just ask for Doc Pearson's place. Everyone knows him. Doc Pearson, the only doctor for miles around, was easy to find. He and his wife Kate quickly confirmed that their cave contained lots of bats. Prior to the arrival of electricity, Kate had relied on one of its cool sinkhole entrances to store milk and cheese. They had never entered the actual cave because of its difficult access. One entrance was a sheer 50-foot free-fall drop to a rugged floor, and the other two were narrow crawlways that sloped precipitously. Despite never having entered, Kate had often been surrounded by emerging or returning bats as she did her chores, and knew better than to be afraid. She and her husband were quite curious to learn more. I guess they trusted me not to get hurt, given that my 6-foot-4-inch tall, muscular father looked quite capable of keeping me safe. He also exuded confidence, even though neither one of us actually knew much about surviving in caves yet. Their cave was located in an oasis of natural wonder in the middle of an otherwise average cow pasture. The shaded sinkhole was lined with moss and fern-covered boulders, surrounded by a small patch of forest where wild raspberry vines and sassafras plants grew. The cave's three entrances connected into a large main room, and a series of complex passages provided warm and cold air traps and stable conditions year-round, ideal for hibernating bats. Bats are among the few true hibernators. The breathing of a hibernating bat is imperceptible. Its heartbeat drops from roughly 400 beats per minute when awake to about 25 in hibernation. Its body temperature often falls to within a tenth of a degree of surrounding cave walls. Some species can even survive sub-freezing body temperatures. Most cannot. Each has its own unique hibernation strategy, and because of its complexity, Pearson Cave could accommodate at least 8 species. For a budding Batman, this was a magical place. We first entered in early December. My father and I had to slither through an icy crevice into a large chamber 60 feet wide by 150 feet long. Almost immediately, we began seeing hibernating big brown bats, Epitessicus fuscus, surrounded by icicles. Raffinesque's big-eared bats, Coronarhinus raffinesci, hung higher up, where they were safe from freezing, their huge ears curled like a ram's horns. And a little farther in, we discovered a wall covered in an estimated 11,000 gray myotis, including a dozen with bands on their forearms. I carefully wrote down the numbers so I could report them. I had never before seen more than a dozen or so hibernating bats, much less such an array of species. On a moist wall near a stream, we found scattered little brown myotis, Myotis lucificus, then tiny tricolored bats, Perimyotis subflavus, beaded in so much moisture condensation that they resembled Christmas ornaments. Aside from their moisture droplet disguise, tricolored bats are easily distinguished from all other cave dwellers by their distinctly tricolored yellowish fur and orange forearms. Unlike gray myotis and big-eared bats, they spend summers roosting in tree foliage, where their fur color conceals them like dead leaves. As my father and I drove home later that evening, I kept exclaiming, "Wow! Can you believe we found so many bats? I wonder how many more there are." And my father reminded me, "We need to find out who else is banding gray myotis and where theirs came from." Once home, I made a beeline to retrieve my banding notes to see how close this other person's band numbers were to mine. I had never suspected the bands could be mine. After all, even if my banded bats did migrate, shouldn't they have gone south for the winter? So I was astonished to find that they were my own numbers. I ran through the house yelling, "Can you believe it? We found our own bats!" Not yet aware of the harm that could be done by disturbing bats too often during hibernation, we returned a week later to share our discovery with my mother, who also was a nature enthusiast. The Pearsons were fascinated to learn that at least some of their bats had come from as far away as Knoxville, but all I could think of was how many more of our banded bats we might find. My mother wasn't enthusiastic about the icy slither to enter, but she was a good sport. We were disappointed to find that all 11,000 of the gray myotis we'd told her about had departed, apparently seeking a more secure hiding place deeper inside. We did find a few hundred gray myotis, but most eluded us. We decided to climb a cedar log some previous visitor had propped against a wall in order to reach a side passage 12 feet up one side of the main entry room. My father steadied it as I, and then my mother, climbed, using nubs of cut-off branches like rungs in a ladder. Then, against my mother's protests, he climbed it alone. We found several thousand gray myotis high above the floor in this passage, but not as many as we'd hoped. I suggested we follow bat droppings down several side passages, but the search was fruitless. Then, to save time, we decided one of us would go ahead and search and report. Since I could scarcely contain my need to explore, and my mother wasn't enthusiastic about crawling down small passages, my parents reluctantly agreed to send me. This was a mistake they would soon regret. Eager for discovery and fearless, as teenagers are, I crawled rapidly along the next passage, leaving my parents to await my return. In my enthusiasm, I failed to notice how narrow it was becoming until my arms were pinned in front of me and I could no longer back up. I had no
sample complete. Ready to continue?